This is James R. Copeland, Director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, and it's my pleasure to have with me today Andrew Grossman, who's an attorney at the Baker Hostetler firm, as well as a visiting fellow with the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where he formerly served as a senior legal analyst. Andrew's been a longtime friend of us at the CLP and at Point of Law, and we always look to his insights in covering many legal topics, including the hot issues of the day before the Supreme Court. So it's my pleasure to have Andrew with us today to talk about an important case that's now before the Supreme Court, Kiobel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum, a case in which oral arguments were recently heard at the court, and then in an interesting turn of events, the court decided to hold the case over to the next term, the October 2012 term, to get further briefing and more oral argument on the case. So, Andrew, it's a pleasure to have you. Tell us a little bit about the Royal Dutch Petroleum, the Kiobel case, and the law that is at issue in the case, the 1789 Alien Tort Statute.
Jim, it's my pleasure to discuss this. Interestingly enough, this is one, Kiobel is one of a large number of alien tort statute cases where foreign plaintiffs try to bring human rights type claims against sometimes foreign corporations and sometimes domestic corporations in U.S. federal courts. And they do that under a statute called the Alien Tort Statute. It's a 1789 statute, and it's 33 words long, and, you know, in the interest of brevity, I'll just read the whole thing. It says, the district court shall have original jurisdiction of any civil action by an alien for a tort only committed in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States. The 33 words were not put into use in any court case that anyone can tell for about 170 years until they were new life was breathed into them in a 1980 case called Filartiga. And since then, although you've had very few judgments in ATS cases, you've had just a flood of these lawsuits against pretty much any large multinational corporation that you could imagine seeking millions of dollars in damages in any instance. The facts here are pretty typical. You had the Abacha military dictatorship in Nigeria that's alleged to have engaged in human rights abuses in the Nigeria Delta region. Largely in the context of exploiting some of the mineral wealth of that area. The claim here is also a pretty common claim. It's an aiding and abetting claim. The allegation is that Royal Dutch Shell Petroleum, which is a foreign corporation, was somehow contributed to these human rights abuses by the very fact that it did any business whatsoever with the government of Nigeria at that time. There aren't really any specific allegations as to what it did or how it was involved or anything like that. The Second Circuit dismissed the case on a ground that's somewhat novel. That ground was the absence of corporate liability under international law. The Alien Tort Statute, of course, speaks specifically of the law of nations, and the Supreme Court has define that to mean obligatory and universally accepted norms of customary international law. Corporate liability, there's a very good argument to be made, is not among them. In fact, it's been rejected in most international treaties. It's been rejected by the International Criminal Court. It's been rejected by international criminal tribunals. There really is a consistent practice of focusing liability for human rights abuses and for international law abuses on individuals, and stems from the Nuremberg trials following World War II. So that was the posture when the case came into the Supreme Court, but what's happened since then, I think, has really thrown a bit of a curveball so far as the case has proceeded.
Well, before we get to the curveball, let's peer into this a little more. I mean, the Second Circuit holding in a split decision written by Judge Cabranes that you're talking about was basically saying the corporate liability, as you say, isn't cognizable under international law. But isn't that decision an outlier of sorts? In other words, aren't the other circuits on the other side of that question, including a Seventh Circuit decision by Judge Posner?
That is true. Judge Cabranes, to his credit, has authored so far three really very influential ATS decisions and is considered to be somewhat of an expert in the law. He's had that opportunity serving on the Second Circuit because they seem to get a lot of this litigation, having been the ones who sort of originated the modern ATS jurisprudence. The other decisions that have ruled on corporate liability, I think, suffer from a common flaw. I mean, first of all, a couple of them came ever so slightly before the Supreme Court's decision in SOSA, which was the first to really provide a framework for how the lower courts ought to consider claims that are brought under the Alien Tort Statute. But the real problem is, I think, a lack of diligence in trying to tease out and trying to properly and carefully and diligently apply the actual requirements that the Supreme Court set forward in the SOSA opinion. You know, it's a common saying, you know, among, you know, that there is no such thing any longer as federal common law. We have statutory causes of action. The Alien Tort Statute creates a bit of an exception to that because it provides a grant of jurisdiction, but it doesn't tell you what the causes of action are. Now, the Supreme Court, recognizing that the courts aren't really in a good position to be making law, and they're especially not in a good position to be making law that affects international relations, that the courts have to, both as a matter of law as well as a matter of policy, have to take a very narrow view of what actually is the obligatory, what are the obligatory norms of international law. There has to be substance there. You have to have case citations. You have to have evidence in treaties and other international documents. You have to have evidence of the practices of nations, what it is that nations believe that they, in fact, have to do under international law. And when you do a survey of that, and interestingly enough, the United Nations has done a survey of this, what you find is that there actually is no consensus on corporate liability. And to the extent, and you can even go farther than that, you can say there is a consensus that international law actually does not recognize corporate liability. I think the strongest evidence for that is probably the Nuremberg trials. Despite the involvement in those trials of a number of executives, dozens of executives of corporations that serviced the Nazi war machine, most prominently the IG Farben company, the judges who discerned the law and applied the law in those cases recognized that it was the individual that had to be held responsible. And indeed, it works in a couple different ways because it was famous in Nuremberg that one thing the judges rejected was the just following orders defense. In other words, you can't shield yourself behind an organization because the organization's acts are ultimately carried out by individuals. And international law subsequent to that has carried through on that tradition. And the tradition also extends backwards in time, too. If you look at early piracy cases and you look at cases concerning safe conduct, as well as the ambassadorial diplomatic relations, you find the same thing, where there has never been a tradition of collective liability. And whenever that concept has been broached, it's been rejected. So there has been a circuit split here, but the circuit split has, on one hand, you know, a very scholarly and thoughtful opinion by the Second Circuit that really reflects a lot of weight of evidence, and on the other hand, a lot of decisions that, and I unfortunately would put the Seventh Circuit decision in this, that say, well, we don't see any pragmatic reason why there wouldn't be corporate liability. Now, I would disagree with that proposition as well, but that's not the right inquiry to begin with.
So now let's get to the curveball. What happened at oral argument, and what has the Supreme Court decided it wants to look at beyond this corporate liability question in assessing the statute, such that it wants more briefs and further oral argument next year?
I think the theme, the mood of the court at oral argument, was probably best summed up by a statement that Justice Kennedy made before the first advocate before the court even got out his second sentence, which is that, expressing a great wariness, and I quote, that the ATS authorizes federal courts to exercise civil jurisdiction over alleged human rights abuses over which the nation has no connection. I think Justice Alito put it even more clearly when he asked, what business does a case like this have in the courts of the United States? I mean, think about it. You have foreign conduct, conduct that occurred entirely overseas. You have foreign defendants, and you have foreign plaintiffs. The nexus to the United States in this case is not attenuated, it's non-existent. And This is something that I think is coming up as a result of the court's decision in Sozo, which the court thought that it was closing the door on a lot of this abusive litigation by specifying a very high standard for recognizing claims under the ATS, but it didn't realize how negligent the lower courts should be in applying that. The court's likening to the merits of these claims. They're really interesting cases, and the allegations in many of them are quite serious, violations of human rights, sometimes torture, sometimes extrajudicial killing. And there's been this great wariness for the courts to carry out the mandate of what the Supreme Court said in Sosa. And I think the mood among the justices on the court was, this really isn't what we envisioned happening. And the question is how to deal with that, how to close the door to this type of abusive litigation. And there are a number of possibilities on the table. One of them, of course, is the question that was presented directly by the case and that the parties briefed, and that was corporate liability. But I think the court realized in considering this case, especially due to something that happened immediately after oral argument, that deciding the case on corporate liability wasn't going to get them where they wanted to go, which was eliminating categorically this type of litigation. And what happened during the interim was the court conferenced the petition for certiorari in the in Rio Tinto v. Sarre, which is a Ninth Circuit case that came out the other way. It allowed that there was corporate liability under the ATS, that there could be, as well as it considered the issue of aiding and abetting liability, as well as extraterritoriality. In other words, whether a statute that doesn't expressly, by its own terms, apply to conduct that occurs overseas should be read to occur to apply to conduct that occurs overseas. That petition was right before the court, and I think the court realized that, well, gosh, you know, you may have some incidental U.S. contacts in other types of cases. You may have individuals who are being sued in federal court rather than corporations. And I think they decided that ruling on corporate liability, it's a very complex issue. It's a very controversial issue. And it's not something that would get them where they wanted to go. And so you had this very unusual circumstance at oral argument where the parties were prepared to brief the corporate liability issue. And I would say a majority of the questions by the court were more concerning the extraterritorial issue. Why is this case even here? Why is this entire class of cases even coming into federal courts? And that really presaged this extraordinary order that we received from the court just on Monday of this week.
So, what are some things the court could do? I mean, what do you think the court should do in handling this, and what do you think they might do in terms of how they're going to resolve this broader question with the ATS?
Well, one thing we know that the court's not going to do is not going to decide this case on the corporate liability issue.
Right.
When the court granted certiorari in Kiobel, it took at the same time a parallel case called Mohammed v. Rajoub that raises the same question of corporate liability under a somewhat more specific statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act. That was, many people thought, a very good signal that the court would try and decide the two cases in tandem and consider the legal issues in a parallel fashion. It's still going to decide Mohammed this term, and Mohammed is a somewhat more straightforward statutory interpretation case, and by oral argument, it appears it might even be a 9-0 decision, finding that only individuals can be liable for these types of offenses under the TVPA. But the fact that it's not going to decide Kiobel at the same time suggests that corporate liability as a basis for decision is off the table. Well, that leaves, I think, a couple, probably three ways that the case could go forward. The one that was really the focused oral argument was extraterritoriality. In general, court jurisdictions are generally coextensive with the sovereignty of their states. Except for very rare exceptions, sovereignty extends to territorial limits. In other words, U.S. laws apply within the United States. French laws apply in France, and it would be unseemly and improper for the United States to specify and to command certain laws of its own that would apply in France. And so there's this very strong presumption that when Congress writes a law, that that law applies within the four corners of the United States. And, you know, there may be a little bit of nuance in that. It may or may not apply on Army bases. It may or may not apply in the high seas, that is, areas of the oceans that are not under the control of any country. But in general, the idea that a statute that does not expressly say that it's going to apply in a foreign country would, in fact, apply in foreign territories, the court has taken a very hard line against that, most recently 3 terms ago in a case called Morrison. There are a variety, as I said, of prudential reasons. When you have, you know, the United States trying to apply its domestic laws in foreign countries, you invariably are going to have diplomatic disputes. You're going to be pulling lots of difficult cases into courts that are ill-suited to deal with them for reasons of discovery and evidentiary reasons. These become very expensive and difficult to prosecute cases. And they embroil the courts in the type of decision-making that in general is probably best left to the executive branch concerning our foreign relations and concerning U.S. goals and policies with respect to foreign conduct. The court is very well aware of this. The court devoted an entire multi-page discussion in SOSA to these very issues and warned against courts embroiling themselves in these types of disputes. But at the same time, it didn't rule on the extraterritorial issue. The justices seem to view this issue front and center at the oral argument last week, and I think that you can tell that in their order that they issued this week, where they actually posed a very specific question for the litigants. And I'll just quote that. Whether and under what circumstances the Alien Tort Statute allows courts to recognize a cause of action for violations of the law of nations occurring within the territory of a sovereign other than the United States. So they've embodied this idea of foreign territories, and I think that that is most likely to be the ground on which they decide the case. But let me mention very quickly two other options. In that question that I just read, the court also used the word circumstances. Under what circumstances? Circumstances, I think, is an oblique way of describing this concept of aiding and abetting liability. U.S. courts might still have jurisdiction. It might not be an extraterritorial application of law. When you have an alien tort statute case that concerns a corporate defendant that's in the United States, it might be a government contractor or something like that. It might have operations overseas that have some degree of management and control from the United States. But you might have a case that in the main is just like the Kiobel case, or is just like the Rio Tinto case. The only difference is that you have a tiny nexus with the United States, not something very significant, but something slight. These are aiding and abetting type cases, and for the same policy reasons, they don't really belong in U.S. federal courts. And I think the idea by asking the court parties to brief the circumstances issue is that you may also see a decision that either eliminates or scales back aiding and abetting liability. Aiding and abetting, of course, is nowhere covered under the Alien Tort Statute. The tort statute, the ATS doesn't refer to it in any sense. The general federal statutes that establish aiding and abetting liability don't apply to the Alien Tort Statute. They only apply to a different section of the U.S. Code. And you have this parallel statute, the Torture Victim Protection Act, that also excludes aiding and abetting liability. So there's a very strong case to be made that the court could eliminate it entirely. Even if the court doesn't do that, at the very least, it's probably likely to restrict aiding and abetting liability to certain mens reas, requiring that the corporation willfully engage in certain types of conduct rather than merely do business with a foreign power. That would at least be enough to knock out cases such as Kulamani, where dozens and dozens of multinational corporations, including Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Mitsubishi and a number of others, were held into court merely because they sold goods to the government of South Africa during the reign of apartheid. It was not alleged in that case that any of those companies were directly involved in any of the specific allegedly unlawful activities carried out by that government, but merely that they supplied that government with goods. So that would be a good way of narrowing the scope of the ATS in a sensible fashion. I think either of those work. Third ground, which the court doesn't really seem very much interested in, but would apply in this particular case, is constitutional jurisdiction. There's no such thing as constitutional jurisdiction for a suit by an alien against an alien. over conduct that hasn't even occurred in the United States. There was a very strong argument to be made that this particular case shouldn't be here at all as a matter of constitutional law. That said, the court could have decided that if it wanted to this time around without setting the case for re-argument. And I think the court really wants to deal with this problem once and for all, and jurisdiction isn't going to be the way to do that because a lot of companies do have substantial contacts in the United States. They may have subsidiary U.S. subsidiaries and other things such that jurisdiction might be available in other instances. So I think they're going to aim big, and I think you're going to see a decision on the basis of extraterritoriality as well as aiding and abetting liability. And from my point of view, I think that would be a perfectly sensible result to scale back a statute to really what it was meant to cover, which was this narrow band of sort of almost diplomatic-type offenses that occur within the territories of the United States. To the extent that we have evidence and knowledge of these things, that seems to be what was on Congress's mind when it passed this statute, 1789.
Fascinating. Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you, Andrew, and shed light on this important Supreme Court case. We're going to keep following it, and we may have you back when the court finally does reach some sort of decision on it. This has again been James Copeland, Director of the Center for Legal Policy, with Andrew Grossman at the Baker Hostetler Firm and a visiting legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.